Hello, and welcome to The Staffing Show, the only podcast that delivers tools, tips, and tactics from the staffing and recruiting industry's top executives and thought leaders.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Staffing Referrals. At Staffing Referrals, we understand the challenges your agency faces every day. From finding high-quality candidates and clients to automating your recruitment process, our platform is designed to help you grow your agency faster. Imagine a world where your agency can automatically build your talent community, improve your recruiter's productivity, and automate manual processes, all the while improving the candidate experience. But don't just take our word for it. Here's what a few satisfied customers have to say. Our referral program boomed after partnering with Staffing Referrals. The technology allows us the tracking, communication, and reporting our traditional referral program desperately needed to unify and expand. Can't imagine our business without it. Are you ready to transform your staffing agency? Let's reduce your dependency on job boards. Deliver the experience your candidates expect from a modern business and turn your talent pool into a competitive advantage. Visit staffingreferrals.com and get ready to grow.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for another episode of The Staffing Show. Today, I am super excited to be joined by Jason Leverant, who is the president and COO of The At-Work Group. Jason, very excited for the conversation today. Excited to have you on the show.
Likewise, David, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is going to be a good one for all of our listeners. We're going to be digging into talking about staffing agency differentiation. We're going to be jumping into AI. Jason's kind of at the forefront on some of the use cases with AI, talking about marketing, and it's going to be a good topic. So let's go ahead and hop in. As always, what I like our guests to do is learn a little bit about you. So if you could just tell us a little bit about how you got into the staffing industry and who is at work.
Yeah, appreciate it. So it's funny, just like many probably listening in, I wasn't planning on joining the staffing industry. When I got into it, I was actually working marketing for a golf manufacturer. So I started in that space and was in the recreation world. And it was as fun as what it sounds like it might be, going on a tour with golf pros and doing all that fun stuff, you know, doing marketing for really golf and tennis products. But all good things must come to an end, I guess, right? So I found myself out there kind of looking for my next adventure and thought I would be like, you know, my father who used this, I didn't know about them, but basically like executive search recruiters or headhunters. And so I said, oh, I'm going to do the same thing. And so I started searching in the, you know, this is 20 something years ago. So the internet was in its very early stages on that side of things. And I stumbled across, oh, these employment agencies. So I thought, oh, this is the same thing. So I went and started knocking on doors, talking with staffing firms and ended up getting offers from two different firms on literally the same day. So it's like the stars aligned and said, you should be in the staffing industry. Ended up starting with Randstad back in early 2003. And so been in the industry ever since, man. It's been a wild ride.
That's great. And one of the conversations, well, tell us a little bit about At-Work.
Yeah. We're a little bit different animal than most staffing firms. You know, at the core, at the consumer side, out in the field, we have branch locations that are traditional commercial staffing branches. So we support industrial, primarily administrative clerical roles, things of that sort, and about 115 pin drops on a map, locations across the US. But behind the scenes, in my office here, we have a team of people that work to support and really take this concept and franchise it. So we're one of the few franchise-based staffing concepts. So all of our branch locations across the US are locally owned. So that's a unique element which helps for us, you know, differentiate when we go to market and really changes a little bit of my day-to-day dynamic and my perspective on the industry, which I feel like helps us kind of drive, be a bit ahead of the curve as it compared to most. But I'm also a franchise owner too, or my wife is a franchise owner. I'm a very like a minority owner in one of our franchise locations.
Well, that's great. You get to feel both sides of it. So, you know, when you make a change, you get to see if it's going well.
Yep. I'm drinking my own Kool-Aid, man. That's what it is.
And how many branches do you guys have today?
Me and my wife have one branch. She just started. She's just that adventurous. She's considering opening her second location, but she's doing it very strategically. We're in Tennessee, East Tennessee, where our headquarters are. She wants to be close to the beach somewhere. So she's being very thoughtful about where we open our next one, if it gives us a nice reason to get to the beach. So we'll see if that ever transpires.
Awesome. And I know that you mentioned that you guys are having some growth this year, which is awesome. One of the things that I was excited to talk to you about is the state of the market and what we've seen in the last couple of years. And I know that, you know, it's been challenging for the last couple of years for a lot. I think we're starting to see things pick up at the moment. And I'm interested in what your perspective is on kind of like how you, I think I heard you at one point saying sometimes staffing can be our own worst enemy. You know, yeah. And I'm like, I'm curious to know, like, what do you think is going on in the industry right now when it comes to kind of the competitive nature of things?
Yeah, well, especially in times like these where there's this level of uncertainty, we've seen kind of top line spend in the industry shrink just a little bit or showing signs of a potential increase now, but it has not been like the last 15 plus years, take the COVID years out, but like really this ramp we've had since the Great Recession in 08, we've just grown as an industry exponentially. And for the last 3 years, though, we've seen kind of a flat line decline and a very, very slow return. And I think everyone said it, and we've looked at it time and time again as industry leaders, but it's really focusing on, you know, really the driver of this malaise is really uncertainty, both from an economic front, kind of a global, could be war, it could be the stock market. There's so many different facets and factors. Now we have AI and automation and the future of jobs in the US and globally. What does that really mean for white collar? What does it mean for the levels of automation we see coming? So all this uncertainty has really driven a little bit of a slowdown. And so when staffing firms start slowing down, they start getting, and I hate to use the term desperate, but it feels very desperate for revenue gains and growth. And when that desperation really drives the demand to grow, we start seeing us become our own worst enemy from a price commoditization perspective. I mean, we're encountering rates in the market that are unbelievably low, unfathomably low. We would never have seen in any times past. And it's difficult. And so, yes, we become our, as an industry, our own worst enemy because these bad actors really poison the well for all of us. And then we have to remain competitive. If we need to keep cash flow moving and keep our staff and our branches with things to do, with job orders to fill, we're fighting in that, we're being drugged down to that space, which is really, really unfortunate.
Yeah. In competitive times, the pricing pressure can be really intense. And also, it's interesting to see, and I've heard of this more recently in the travel nursing space, but with like kind of the newer startups where it was like they're pricing it in a way that like they can't be profitable. And that's what everybody thinks. And then a year from, you know, after a year goes by, you find out actually the model wasn't profitable. So it is a.
Exactly. And then it's too late. You've already lost your money. And yeah.
So what are some of the things that, in terms of like, you know, holding on price, but also, you know, delivering the value and differentiating your product, how are you guys going to market? What are some of the things that you do to make sure you're showing up as a differentiated service?
Yeah. And so something, again, I kind of referenced it earlier, but something that's unique in our model is the fact that we're a franchisor. So we kind of get this unique benefit, as do many others, but we use it as in our minds, a strategic advantage is the fact that we have local ownership close to where the action happens, to where the rubber's meeting the road, where the service is delivered. And inherently, studies have shown, research has shown that service levels are exponentially higher when you have a true vested interest, not a perceived one, but an actual ownership, a stake at that local level. So what we bring to the table is this high level white glove service and approach to how we engage with our clients, how we engage with our talent, how we engage with the community. We're a part of the community in every one of our branches. And I know there's people out there who work for companies and take ownership in their role. So I'm not taking it away from them. But in this instance, they truly are owners of the business. They don't take ownership. They have ownership. And it's something that we found is a really strong piece that we sell. But at the same token, everyone says they really service better. And so you can say it all day long. It's showing up and actually executing on it. And so we run studies behind our claims, and we consistently see exponentially higher levels of customer satisfaction, talent satisfaction, things of that sort. We're pretty rabid about our NPS scores. We're constantly polling and assessing and looking at how we do things, testing change, testing, you know, yes, we can make a change and become more efficient, but what does that do to the client experience? What does that do to the talent experience? And I know we've, you know, you alluded to it earlier, but we actually have this concept, this requirement that we want to keep a human involved in everything we do all the time, that human in the loop idea, which we can talk about later. But that service, especially in our world, we have to make sure that service is put first, and we have to frame our efficiency gains. We have to frame our innovations and change in process around this focus that we can't drop the ball around that white glove service.
And so it sounds like you are not only focused on making sure they're delivering the service, but you're measuring it across multiple angles. Like you're measuring NPS, doing client talent, like doing all of the above across the, for measuring the, like how you guys are serving the customers.
Absolutely. Yeah. We service and we don't do it. You know, there's the best of staffing survey that goes out as kind of a national thing. But we also look at kind of trigger events that would, for us, are good times to capture how did we do. So end of assignments, beginning of assignments, new customers, you know, conversions and things of that sort, just to make sure that we're taking that litmus test, like taking the measurements in a science experiment, that we do it regularly and we can adapt to any changes or any situational components that we just maybe wouldn't catch if we were only doing it once a year.
Yeah. And how are you bringing that feedback back to the franchise owners, the recruiters? How are you making sure that that happens? And is it something you're doing consistently in real time? Is it something you're doing on a quarterly basis?
Yeah. So that's the beautiful thing about the franchise model is we have support teams. Think about them like business coaches assigned to every franchise owner that helps them be an extra set of eyes and ears, and they can deliver. So we manage all the survey responses. And when we get them in, we kind of go hand to hand with these franchise owners.
Oh, that's great. So you're going out and actually coaching them.
Oh, absolutely. When we share the data with them, and then it's how do we extract insights from it? But in that same token, again, remember, we have an owner who has a vested interest. It hits them where it hurts the most or the best in their wallets.
Yeah.
and if there's an impact or a positive thing, great. They can high five, they can reward, they can add a boy, add a girl. If it's a negative, they can go in and start coaching up to change. And it's really important. And it's interesting, the difference in response when you have an owner involved. It's incredible.
Yeah, that is incredible. And are you open to sharing any of the things that stand out for high NPS, any of the attributes that you'd be open to sharing?
Communication. I mean, is it funny that the basics, it's really focus on the basics and really you win. Everything else just adds flavor, adds elements. But at the end of the day, really clear communication, consistent communication is absolutely critical. Communication with good news and communication with bad news or just transparent news, letting them know. And we found that one component, that, and I would say preparing your talent for a new job or a new client.
Yeah.
People don't, I'll tell you, at the end of the day, we take it for granted. We put people to work all the time and we just think it's normal course of business. For us, it is.
Yeah,
oh, we've got David going out to work at XYZ. I know XYZ. I know David, but David doesn't know XYZ. And so how are we going to help him be ready to go to work in a overt sort of way? How can we think about every avenue? How can we make him super comfortable? Because you can never really go too far on that front. We can do everything we can. And all we're doing is preparing them for this new role. And so that preparedness, that communication, we don't want any surprises. In our mind, surprises are usually bad. That creates, you know, potential risk. There could be even to the point of safety and environmental risk and things like that, where maybe we didn't communicate a job, a role, or environment or whatever correctly to an employee, and we missed something. And we put them in a position where we've created a greater risk for injury or accident or whatever the case may be. So we just, again, communication, transparency, preparedness, and not just on the client end. Yes, they are writing the check, they are placing the order, but the talent are the ones actually filling the jobs and they're the ones in our face while we're not there. And so making sure that they're comfortable, they're prepared, their skills, they're the right person for the job. That's really what it comes
to. Yeah.
Again, basics. This is like 101 stuff, man.
It is.
But you'd be surprised how far it'll get you.
It is. And we should actually say that the NPS is net promoter score, which is a question.
Yeah.
I feel like that conversation enough times with people where I'm like, oh, you know, what is NPS? So I think it's a metric that helps you rate how well you're doing. And it's one of the core metrics that you can use to kind of identify your reputation out there in the market. It sounds like you're really putting the candidate experience first and thinking about how they're doing things. One part that you mentioned on the communication side of this, I have over the years done NPS for different sales teams. And the thing that we consistently saw when we would do the NPS, and we just, you know, the entire sales, every individual on the sales team would get, we would tie their customers back to that individual NPS. And it was response time was like 80% of it. It was like not even to your point on like good news or bad news. It was the
tell them something.
We would like look at their emails and they're like, they would just respond on it, you know? And then like give them updates on what was going on a regular basis. And it had a huge impact. So that's really great. One of the other areas that you and I talked about briefly before this call was the impact and importance of having kind of the local setup, which I know you mentioned a little bit about how important it is to have the physical presence, but I had not thought about the marketing elements of that and the value behind that. And I thought you kind of had a unique perspective on how valuable it can be from a handful of ways. I'd love for you to dig into that a little bit.
Yeah. So I think we had shared that in our model, we still have bricks and mortar branch locations in the markets that we're in. And so again, we're very kind of avid proponents of having that local presence, being a part of the community, really selling on the fact that you're part of the community. And so having a physical location there creates a kind of a rallying point. One, the type of business we do, it's absolutely critical industrial talent, entry-level clerical talent, bringing them in, laying eyes on the talent to screen, to build rapport with the talent, to communicate with them, to place that they can go if there's an issue with their check or an issue with time or whatever the case may be. It's a level of comfort that can be had. But, you know, there's a big movement to kind of work from home and go remote, and you don't need a physical office anymore in the market. I almost laugh at that just a little bit, because at the end of the day, we run P&Ls and we look at our branch locations, and the cost of a rented location, let's just say on average, it's $2,000 a month or something like that. What does that give me? And in most cases, in most communities, I have a retail-esque location with a sign, with some glass and some opportunities to put some advertising on the glass, if you will. Rarely, and at times, we're in buildings and things like that in larger markets, and that's less impactful. But 90% of the time for us, we have physical locations. And I tell folks, I said, listen, this gives you not only the office space, a place to build culture and rapport with your team, to spend time face-to-face with them, to motivate, engage. We have whiteboard meetings. We do all the old, you know, I hate to say old school things, but high impact activities that help us thrive in the markets. But at the end of the day, so I have all that. But now I just tell people, have you ever looked at the cost of a Lamar billboard, like on the highway, even in these small towns? To put a billboard on the highway is like $4,000 a month, $3,000, $4,000 a month. You're committing to like 4-year contracts. Sometimes you can get it a little bit less or shorter, but it's way more expensive. Look at it that way. At minimum, you get a billboard in your community with a sign on it that you can display advertising for the most part. We put QR codes, apply now on our glass. It becomes a billboard. So I get a billboard and a place where I can be a part of the community, manage my team, build culture with my team, and it's half the cost of what I would pay for just some graphic on the side of the road. So I don't see the argument. And so we've stayed pretty true to the old bricks and mortar branch location, have people work, come together. It's worked really well for us. And like you said earlier, we're up for the year and fairly substantially over the industry averages. So it's far so good for us.
Yeah, that is amazing. I had not thought about the value of that and then what the actual cost structure is for it. And you could spend that in Google Ads to open up a market on a monthly basis. You know, like you could.
But and I would argue, I would still spend some with Google Ads just to get your word out. But that's a whole different package. So
yeah. Do both, and also just feed on Google Maps when somebody types from staffing and like all of the elements that. Yeah, tell me a little bit. I mean, we talked about your.
You're like speaking my language, man, because I am hardcore on Google reviews. Having your Google location, asking for reviews. If you look at some of our locations. One in particular I like to brag about is in Raleigh, North Carolina. Our owner, Jerry Bland, has almost 500 or over 500 five-star reviews now. And he's by far the number one rated staffing firm in North Carolina. So just last week, one of the Raleigh major news stations, I think it was Fox, reached out to him. And how did they find him? Well, you're the top rated staffing firm. So they wanted commentary on the job market. And they go to the top rated staffing firm in the community. And Raleigh's a pretty good market, man. So that's, to me, is major props to Jerry for what he's doing locally. You know, I brag about my wife. I think she's got over 200 five-star reviews. It's incredible. We have offices all over and we do competitions on who can review. Because at the end of the day, it's like we buy products on Amazon. I'm going to buy the one that has the highest review. If I see two products, the same products side by side, and one's a five-star review and the other one's a 3.5, I don't care if it's a couple dollars more. I'm buying the 5-star because there's something inherently better about it.
I can't imagine purchasing things without reviews. And I mean, that's the world we live in. I mean, the stats behind it are kind of astronomical as well. It's like 97% of consumers read reviews online. 41% say they always read reviews when browsing for businesses. And it's up 29% from last year. And like the impact that it has on your search rankings, on your traffic to your website, on your visibility, it's a lot. And even with like Thumbtack, or it doesn't matter what platform I'm looking at, I'm always looking at the reviews first, trying to filter for the top people. And so I think that's a great focus. And you're tying that into, do you have a process of when you ask and how you ask? And is that all dialed in at the branch level as well?
Yeah, we provide recommendations on when it should occur. I always like to tell people to ask during what I call the honeymoon phase, where you have a trigger event when you've captured an audience. Let's say you have talent you're about to assign or deploy on assignment. Hey, by the way, if you'll complete this Google review, it'll really help me. The recruiters ask that. It'll really help me out in my role. And obviously, they find great results there. Other times, if we have somebody go permanent, temp to perm, and they haven't actually done a Google review, we ask them to do it. We don't say, hey, give us a 5-star review. We said, hey, can you go on a Google and review? We try to keep it as straightforward and ethical as possible. But you have to be strategic about when you ask. It is a request. And so but we do ask. And I tell people, you have to ask, because you think about the other side. You talk about as humans, we rely on reviews so frequently. And if you read a lot of reviews, you'll realize that there are so many people that will get on if they have a bad, even a somewhat bad experience, or even a neutral experience, you'll get a really low review, even if it wasn't a direct experience with your business. And those are the people who go out and actively go negatively reviews. So we have to outweigh negative reviews with positive reviews. And so that's where you have to go out and ask for it, because it's not going to be their natural inclination to go out there and, hey, I'm going to review them on Google. But if you nudge them or ask them, then absolutely. It takes 2 seconds. They jump on, they do the review. We have QR codes sitting on every recruiter's desk that brings them straight to our page. And so we tell them, hey, just scan it with your phone and you're good to go.
Well, something you made it part of the culture and the process. So you've got it dialed in. So you're focused on it on all fronts. One of the other moments that you and I had a conversation around is how you look outside of the staffing industry for what works, which is something I believe in so strongly. I always feel like, oh, we're staffing, we're different, is a mindset that I don't always get behind. I always think, not that it's, there are nuances to how things operate, but I think a lot of times the best ideas come from outside the industry. I would love to know, what are some of the ideas you've seen outside of the industry that you've either brought in to At Work, or what are some of the things that you're excited about and think are going to be tactics that you use going forward?
Oh, yeah. I am a huge fan of looking outside of the industry into to retail and to services industries. Personally, I feel like we can, at times, it feels like we're stuck in maybe the early 2000s. It doesn't feel like much has changed since when I started with Randstad back in 2003. So how do we change the game? Well, it's a lot of times it means looking outside and seeing what's working in other industry types. And so, you know, for us, we started, I mean, even at the core level, when you walk in one of our branches, it feels a lot different than most staffing branches. I mean, we're very focused on the talent experience. So when they walk in, it needs to feel different. It needs to feel almost like aspirational. It feels very nice when you are very clean, very modern. They're greeted. We have SLAs, kind of where we engage with talent.
That's great.
When they come into our branches, and that's critical on the front end. And when people drive by, or when clients walk in, they're like, wow, this isn't like
what you're used to.
Yeah. That I've been in before. It just feels different. And so that's been our goal. And we pulled a lot of that from various other franchise, you know, we mentioned we're franchise. And so we spend a lot of time looking at franchise concepts, and we see really cool ideas and concepts that we steal aesthetically in our branches that are replicatable. And that's the beautiful thing, is we want to be able to deploy a thing and make sure we can do it systemically across 100 plus branches, and we grow and it makes sense for somebody to do it. But at the same time, we're seeing really cutting edge tech that's hitting the retail space. Cause you know, in the big scheme of things, as an industry, we're still relatively small. And so if you go to these retail trade shows or these retail tech conferences, you start seeing some stuff that's at like the bleeding edge of retail. And some of it's absolutely incredible. One of which I think we had actually chatted about offline, about some AI technology that sits as a camera inside the door of your office. So somebody walks into your office and they immediately can tell based on their phone IP effectively, or their MAC address, or some other type of technology. And I'm not really sure. I know enough to be dangerous, but it basically can tell you really where this person travels, where this person has shopped. It's like cookie tracking, but in real life with their phones. And so, guys, it's not like a creepy thing that staffing is thinking about doing. It's actively being used in so many retail stores that we go in today. So they know, and they're watching those cameras, what you go and look at, where you spend a little bit of time looking at on a shelf. They know what SKUs are on that shelf. And that's why when you leave, you get those ads that are targeted. They're saying, I was just looking at that thing on the shelf. Because it's tracking literally everything we do. It knows area you live in. It's collecting demographic data. So for us as recruiters, and people want to deploy, we have somebody walk in and it's using the data and intelligence that it gathers, saying, David lives in this area, eats at these places, likes these different things. So could we see a future where it's providing job recommendations based on various external demographic data and big sets of data to say, these would probably be of interest to him based on proximity, based on potential median wage information, and so on and so forth. It's incredible, scary. We're already succumbed to it. That's the reality. It already exists around us. So how do we, and that's very extreme, but that's the type of technology that we should be looking at. But I think we still are kind of stuck in this rut of, you know, looking at some very base element things that are really challenging for us to implement and so on. So how do we break those chains and start implementing some of this really cool forward-thinking stuff to change the experience for our clients and our talent? That goes back to all that matters is the experience of the clients and the talent. How do we meet them where they want to be met, deliver our services most effectively, and we win market share if we can do that? And that's the goal. And so all these things, all they lend to is making it a better experience for clients and talent, and then we win.
Sounds like you're kind of in a very good way, obsessed about the talent and the client experience and focused on how do we make that better, which is exactly the right place to be. And are there any other things that you've implemented over the years that you think that have had like a really big impact? It sounds like the actual aesthetic and the experience of the talent coming in, were you able to, do you measure an ROI on that? Or are there other tactics that you've put in place where you're like, wow, I don't think this was happening in staffing until we kind of pulled this in?
Oh man, good question. You know, we kind of explored everything. When I joined At Work and kind of was really promoted to the position, I started really from the ground up. In 2012 is when I was promoted to president, and the founder is effectively retired. He said, here, I want you to take this organization and go forward. So, you know, really rebuilding it from the ground up, you know, technology right now, that's all, everyone's looking at technology. I mean, heck, I was talking about technology implementation, but that just really, in my mind, and I think we have to keep drilling it into ourselves, that's augmenting the experience. But at the end of the day, this is still very much a relationship-based industry where it's a human connection. We're still impacting people's lives. So in my mind, I think us driving our underlying mission, maybe it isn't anything novel, but it's really this driving focus. Every person that walks through our doors, they know what our mission is. They know our focus is to make an impact in our clients' and talents' lives. And we do that through high levels of service. We do it through the experience that they have. And so again, it's not anything novel. It's just a reaffirmation of some of the basics. And then it's creating this culture, this kind of unyielding culture of service first and service focus. And for us, that's really what's driven. And that may not be as exciting or cool or innovative as what someone might think, but it's funny because it is fairly rare in this day and age. We play in our markets and we find a lot of our competitors aren't focused on that. They're focused on purely just scraping by and invoicing a new customer at whatever rate just to get it. And then they usually lose it, and we come in and we service better and we win and retain customers.
On the note of, I mean, it sounds like operational discipline and really good execution. And the most recent state of staffing that we just came back and we looked at the highest leverage elements that tied and correlated with growth. And it was the most boring one was the highest correlation was operational discipline. It was, do you have meetings holding your team accountable? Do you have processes? Do you have goals? You know, it's like the basics.
Yeah. As a franchisor, what's a franchise? You think about McDonald's, you think about Subway. Yeah. It's a process. And that's what we do. We build a consistent process and we execute. And we hold our field team accountable to helping our field execute on the standard processes. We call them playbooks. I have a sales activity playbook. It's how we execute on sales. And it's like running plays on a football team. You know, we run the plays, we do the same plays, and they win. If they don't win, we change the plays and we try to find the one that wins. And that's the goal.
Well, it's interesting talking about with you having a franchise model versus the, you know, a lot of the people that are listening to this have their team and their managers that are, you know, reporting directly to them. Franchise is a little bit different relationship. And I would argue maybe even harder to implement change. What are some of the challenges that you've learned over the year or had over the years? And are there any ways that you've been able to get people on board in a more impactful way?
Yeah, change is hard, whatever environment you're in. But yeah, you really called it. You would think when change is made in a company-owned environment where we have employees, we just tell them this is what it is and this is what we're doing. And it's because I said so kind of situation. But we know that's not how it is in life. You need to create buy-in. You need to create engagement. The same in our world. I would say it's actually more challenging because we have folks that are they're owners. They're entrepreneurs. It's not an employee-employer relationship. This is a partnership that we're in. And I have to show them why the change. I'm selling really why this change is beneficial for them and for the entire organization. And then if we can mandate something, then we try, but we do it very tactfully. And so it's challenging, but it's definitely doable. And we've done a number of changes over the years. We've attempted to change, and sometimes we pull back. We're also realistic and we're reasonable as well too. And so we are willing to adapt because we know everybody brings a valuable input and experience and observations. Because again, for the most part, we're not in the field every single day. We're not out there talking to clients and talent every single day. They are. And so we have to, they're our eyes and ears into the realities of that market. And again, now that my wife is an owner, I get to hear about it all the time, man. So I don't ever get away from it. So yeah.
You've got the real time feedback loop happening at the tightest.
Oh man, every night at dinner.
Like, this is a bad process. We're changing it today. I love that. So I want to jump into AI. I don't think you can do a podcast today without talking about AI. I will say that our earlier conversations, I think you might be as far out at the forefront as anybody I've talked to that's working at a staffing firm that is not a technical person. What I'd love to know is where you know, cutting through kind of some of the hype, where is AI actually delivering value for you today? And do you have any experiences or things that you put in place where you can see a measurable ROI, or how are you using it at Network?
Yeah. Just to kind of add some color to what you had mentioned, I have my OpenClaw device sitting at my Mac Mini sitting under my desk mounted and running my fleet of agents doing various tasks. And, but I know that's really, you know, not the reality for most people.
And yeah.
Most people are basically lucky to have either Copilot turned on their MS365 licensing, or maybe they have a ChatGPT or a Claude account. You know, personally, I feel like you have to be using it today in order to, you know, even at a base level, using it today. And most people are. I saw it, was it OpenAI just surpassed like a billion users or something like
That's so crazy.
Incredible amount of users. Yeah. And Claude is just keeps ramping up. They just dropped their new release. And so there's this battle back and forth. It's like Ford Chevy kind of, you know, battle. Which one do you choose or whatever. But whichever one you choose, I just recommend use it, but use it responsibly. Use it under a paid account. It's like $20 a month for those of that are listening and don't have a corporate sponsored account. But the reality is it creates an opportunity to really expand your ability to do things. And I was telling you the way most people use it today, and it feels like a glorified search engine. A lot of people just put it into like basically like they do a Google search, or and that's what they're looking for results. Or maybe it's like compose this email or help me write this thing or whatever the case may be. And they're purely generating some form of content at a base level. But I tell so many people, I actually just did a little kind of mentor session with one of our up and coming accounting staff who's pursuing their minor in applied AI, is the light bulb will go off when you start seeing autonomous agents doing things on your behalf. And for me, that's when it really clicked that there can be a massive, massive efficiency gain. So we're actively kind of in the lab playing around with creating autonomous agents in, you know, kind of guide and framework to help do certain aspects. Aspirationally, we want to see automated, you know, reference checking and automated different components of the business. See, there's so many things that already exist out there that what I would consider, and I don't want to knock any vendors out there that are partners of ours or anybody else, but there's a lot of vendors out there who are selling a feature, like a piece, a small piece of the puzzle, which these new tools should be able to create and automate at very low to no cost very, very quickly. And so I personally believe that we're going to see how we, as an industry and as a society, the way we view kind of SaaS software is going to change. And I think those that are out there in the SaaS software industry should be taking note. And I know they are taking note of how do I start delivering a greater level of value than what somebody can go whip together with a Claude Code and automate. And despite it not being anywhere as near as eloquent from a code basis, what that SaaS platform is, it gets the job done. And that's all they're really looking to do. So I kind of went the long roundabout way on your question, but we're actively looking at ways to implement AI. We're doing it on our business intelligence and our reporting end. We're doing it in our screening end. We have tools that will screen candidates to a limited extent. We're being really careful with that. We have presence in a number of states where there's regulations. So we don't want to make sure we fall within the guidelines of the various state laws and things of that sort. So we're looking ultimately to deploy it in every department within our corporate organization in some form or fashion. You know, in what unique way can we install an autonomous agent or a support agent? And so that's our project in the near term, is to engage with our department leaders, you know, identify use cases, even if they're simple use cases, and execute on it and deliver on it at a very base level.
You're the first person I think I've talked to. I brought up OpenClaw. I also have my Mac Mini over here, and I bring that up with people, and they're like, what are you talking about? Like, it'll open your eyes very quickly. What are some of the use cases for you that have been like surprised you the most? What are some of the things that you've done where you're like, oh, holy cow, I had no idea?
Well, you know, for us, and these are really early, so, and I'm getting people comfortable from the marketing end of the spectrum, really creating autonomous marketing resources and schedules where obviously we need to keep humans in the loop verifying, but eventually we put enough parameters around our prompting. We won't need to have as much human. It would be more of just spot checking. It's like any employee, right? Initially, you don't trust that they're going to get it right, but you'd be surprised how fast it starts getting it right very, very quickly. And we're not talking about just basic graphics. We're talking video campaigns, motion graphics, social media, like a holistic approach, to the point where I would dare say I could probably stand up an entire digital marketing agency with OpenClaw and a couple add-ins, and we could run this thing humanless. But that's never going to happen for us.
Yeah.
We are way too anal about what we put out there, and we want to make sure we have eyes on everything. Yeah. And so accounting are really low hanging fruit use cases for payroll processing. You know, again, although for us, just rewinding back as a franchisor, we're a service company to our franchisees. So it's all about high levels of service. It's about experience for our franchise owners. So yes, we'll automate where we can, but we're not going to take a human out of the equation, a relationship that's built between an owner and ourselves, because we are a service company and we are really dedicated, committed to keeping a human in the loop there.
Yeah, it is such a crazy thing to think about how it's changing work for all of us and how much more, like, we're just on the cusp of what it's about to change. I feel like the human in the loop thing is going to be something we all get more and more comfortable with as we realize that there's a lot of our jobs that it's like, what I think OpenClaw was the moment where I was like, oh, if it can be done on a computer, which is what all of us do all day, it can be done with AI.
I came to the exact same conclusion. And that's where, you know, for me, I was almost a kind of a naysayer. I'm like, AI is not going to take jobs away. And then I experienced OpenClaw and I'm like, oh my gosh, it has the real potential to do that. And if this is like it in its infancy,
yeah,
just imagine where we are in a decade. And I mean, it's
the new Claude Fable is like an 80% on agentic coding and also can take over your computer and run your computer as well. And it is.
Yeah, Cowork is incredible.
Like the thing that I feel like so many people are like, oh, I use it for this, it's okay. And I'm like, it's about getting, if you get the context right, if you have the right direction, the right kind of organization, the right harness for it. And then like people figure out, one of my favorite things with friends is they'll be like, I don't know where I would use it. And I'm like, what's your biggest challenge? Like, what are you struggling with right now? Just to tell just it
put,
that.
Yeah.
Just put that tell in
it
there.
And ask it, hey, how can I automate this or whatever? What we're using, and it sounds like almost, you know, it's like not cannibalism of code, but like we'll use ChatGPT to draft our prompts, like extensive, huge prompts.
That's it.
For Claude Cowork. I mean, it's like we're doing, you know, because it's, you know, for me, I also, the light bulb comes on because when you start using agentic AI, you have to be especially one that is intended to be autonomous, you have to be very careful with what your prompting looks like. And so we're not talking about like two sentence prompts or even a paragraph prompt. We're talking pages long prompting to be very granular in that approach. And so we use ChatGPT to create 5.5 to create prompting for Claude. Now Fable, I haven't really played with Fable that much on that front. It's too expensive, by the way, in OpenClaw. Yeah,
I ran out of tokens in 30 minutes.
Yeah, for real, man. Yeah. But, you know, so going back around to your original question, I mean, I could tell you, you know, yeah, we're using chatbots with our talent that does screening and interviews and helps match to kind of take all that. That's kind of par for the course right now in the reality we live in. Those things, to me, you kind of have to be looking at these to stay competitive, to stay from an efficiency standpoint. But what we're talking about, man, this is really the future. And if you can bring this, I mean, I was toying around with this idea of creating as a use case or an experiment, a fully autonomous humanless staffing firm with chat agents that are prompted to focus on service, to engage. And I believe there's some platforms out there. I haven't engaged with them yet, but there's a platform that helps facilitate a fully automated staffing service where client engages with your robotic agents. We name them and everything. We have a talent pool. So we would pick like one vertical. We'd probably create a new brand just because it's a test. We'd create a small brand and focus on, I'm making this up right now, but security guards or banquet serving or something like that, and put it out in the market and just test it fully autonomous, but focused on service, focused on communication, focused on all the things we talked about. Maybe we, you know, 6 months, 9 months down the road, we'll get back on a call like this and I'll tell you about it if we end up executing on a plan.
I mean, one of the previous podcasts I had on was Meet Dwight, who is maybe that. Is that who you're talking with?
No. Actually, the guy's at Wolf, but I actually had dinner with the founder and CEO of Dwight. So, yeah.
Yeah, I had not thought of this, but so they're building autonomous agents to do services, like accounting services. And they were actually talking about white labeling those and giving them to staffing agencies for staffing agencies to sell. So you can see.
Wow. So, you know, I'm in the industrial space, man. So it's kind of the same argument. And this is a whole nother worth of podcast is humanoid robots. Now that you put humanoid robots with AI, onboard AI, that's like holistically aware, we're seeing that. I mean, I figure did that stream. I don't know if you watched the live stream where it was sorting packages and basically hit human numbers with zero inaccurate. It was incredible. Incredible. Yeah. So I mean, that's next, man.
It is a weird time to be alive. It's exciting. And it's one where I'm just like, well, it's happening. So let's lean in, lean in and learn. So I know you brought this up quite a few different ways in terms of the human in the loop. And, you know, I think there's the what you're talking about is like, what are the things that we can have this do that maybe aren't really value add for a human and maybe something that they wouldn't want to do? What's your viewpoint on, it's a hard question, but you know, a few years out, how do you see the role of the franchise owner or the recruiter changing? What do you think that the version of in the loop will look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think as in many industries, we slowly see ourselves less becoming the executor of the action and more becoming the orchestrator of the actions. And I actually just sat in an AI session at a local university here, and they were talking about this idea of like kind of three variants. You have human or AI with human in the loop or human on the loop or humanless, human out of the loop, which is like, it's basically levels of involvement. And I think we'll see that where the human out of the loop will be the very base, what I would almost consider traditional matching RPA type automations, like an if this, then that consistent approach, where a human on the loop is more of the, you know, we're just really looking at stuff and making sure we become a true, just quality inspector, if you will, of the work of AI. And we have to watch it because it's happening so fast. We're looking for exceptions and things like that, where a human in the loop is basically using the AI as a tool to do your job more efficiently, more quickly, or whatever the case may be. And so I think we're going to see that be the case now with recruiting and, you know, the human engagement. I think we'll still see that human in the loop versus on the loop or out of the loop for most cases where we have, you know, until it's some form of a future, as humans, especially in America here, our personal identities are really tied to our jobs, like what we do. I mean, when you meet somebody new, you usually have, oh, hey, what's your name? Common expert. What do you do for a living? You know, that's kind of a common, that's our identity, right?
Yeah.
And so that's very personal to us. So I still think recruiters, we're engaging with people, talking about that thing that is still innately personal to them. And as long as that's the case in our culture and in our society, I think we're going to see humans heavily involved in the recruiting and talent engagement side of the process, especially in a position where we're helping somebody find a role that would be more lasting, that has the potential to be a longer term career. If we're talking about pure transaction type relationship, think about like an Uber driver requesting a ride or whatever the case may be, and I provide a service as a human, I drive somebody somewhere. That's very transactional. That can be automated out.
Waymo's here.
Well, now we're even talking a whole nother animal. That's that autonomous piece, but like humanoid robots, which again, another discussion. So I think as long as that stays the case, we'll have humans in the loop on conversations around longer term employment, things of that sort, non-transactional type employment opportunities, non-gig type employment opportunities, where we use these tools like a skilled tradesman uses the next available tool in their specific trade, the next DeWalt cordless accessory in our tool, tool belt that we use to do our thing faster or more efficiently so we can remain competitive. You know, we want to think we can make more money with it, but really at the end of the day, we remain competitive with our peers who are also wielding these same tools.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I feel like they're tools that we have at our disposal, and we should use them and move forward with it. I kind of want to wrap up with, and I know we talked a little bit about At Work at the beginning of this, but as a franchise, why are staffing owners coming to you guys? Why are they choosing to open up a branch with At Work?
Yeah, great question. We are one of a handful of staffing franchisors that exist out there, and we're actually the only one. And I would recommend kind of taking a look at the different options if you have any interest in entering the staffing industry. Or if you're in the industry, if you had this inkling of, hey, you know what, I could do it myself, or I could do it on my own, come talk to us and we can show you kind of uniquely and how distinctly different At Work is. Our model creates a much more independent feeling structure than the other models out there, where those might feel more like you're, you know, running a book of business for the franchise. So it's primarily in the structure and how we've created our franchise opportunity, you know, but we're very efficient, we're very effective, and we're very forward thinking. And that's really driven a lot of our interest in our brand. And we've got phenomenal marketing, amazing leadership team, and just we put all the parts and pieces together to create, in my mind, one of the leading staffing companies, not just franchise companies, but franchises and staffing firms in the US.
That's great. And you've got the growth to back it up this year. So beating the industry is a nice place to be.
Yeah, and shameless plug, we're offering an incredible opportunity for staffing industry pros. We're deferring franchise fees, we're taking requirements down, we're making it like so easy to step into your own branch.
Awesome. It was great talking to you, and have a great day.
Thanks for listening to The Staffing Show. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletter at staffinghub.com to never miss an episode. Until next time.